Well, good morning, folks. It's good to be back with you guys. I got in at 2:30 this morning from Costa Rica, so I'm still functioning on a little less than normal sleep. And part of the reason why I got back at 2:30 in the morning instead of the intended nice early evening arrival was because this world has gone completely crazy and wrong, hasn't it? Have you guys ever felt that way, like the world has all gone wrong, that Jesus is not in control anymore and something else is happening on this planet? I think sometimes I feel that way as I walk out there and I look at some of the things that are happening. And last night was certainly no exception to that. I come into the airport. There's a 6:30 flight out of Miami back here. I'm getting into Miami. We get in a little early, so we go, you know what, we can make this. We got to get through passport control. I head for passport control, and you know how you do that, right? You get off the front of the plane, you fly as fast as you can, because if you're there first, you can get in. And I get in the little line, and I'm like, we've done it! And I'm traveling with a buddy, and he's in the other line, and we're ready. And I go to the passport guy, and usually this is how it works, right? Ba-dink! Welcome back to the U.S., sir. Thank you for coming. Thank you. Straight for the other. But this time it went like this. Ba-deep. That's how it went. Guy walks up and I'm like, this is not looking good for me. And the guy looks and they whisper to each other for a second, and then the guy goes, sir, would you come with me for a second? And I'm like, oh no, here we go. So then, in essence, you leave the freedoms of the United States of America and you walk into some other world. It's like the Twilight Zone. I'm telling you, I'm like, whoa, what just happened? So you go into this little room and they tell you to wait, and 2.5 hours later, I got out of passport control. So it turns out, right, like my dad, who is ex-military, he has a security company that works in Afghanistan and Baghdad, right? So he's in the process of some things there. And these days, if your name is tied to anything in that region of the world, ding! So after 2.5 hours, this is what I get. Thank you, sir. Have a nice day. So I say, I'm just curious, what was this about? Oh, we can't tell you that, sir. That was it. I leave passport control. I mean, listen, I leave that place. I get on the plane. I look at my email right before we take off to come here now at 11:25 at night. And I'm looking at my email, and I get an email from our adoption agency, which you've been working with. We made 2 weeks of incredible progress over the last 2 weeks. We felt like we finally got things nailed down where we can move forward fast. I get an email, and it sets us back 4 weeks. So I'm like, whoa, you just took away the last 2 weeks plus some. And we're starting from scratch again. And I'm sitting on the plane going, there's just something wrong with the world, isn't there? Sometimes you feel that way when you go to work, when you go to your schools, when you go to your communities, when you find yourself in the reality of the everyday world in which you live. Sometimes, I think for me, it feels like that world is bigger, stronger, and harder than you are. And if you are called by God to go into that world, to display his mercy, to share the good news of Christ, to live out the reality of that freedom, I think that it's incredibly difficult to do that sometimes because you feel like you're the weak one and the world is the strong one. And you are helpless and at their mercy. And so Jesus describes to us, we are on the winning side. Even though sometimes it does not feel that way. And then, as though to demonstrate this, he lives out in Luke chapter 8 several events that take place that show us some things. These events begin here in Luke chapter 8 in verse 22. It says, one day Jesus said to his disciples, let's go over to the other side of the lake. Of course, the lake here, the Sea of Galilee, it's called a lake because it's about 10 miles from top to bottom and about 4 miles across, so it's not huge. You can get across it pretty easily. When those storms come up, it is a tough lake to be on because it's big enough that it gets really ugly and shallow enough, as you remember if you were here when we talked about this. They head over the lake and they encounter a massive storm. Jesus gets up after sleeping in the back of the boat, puts the storm to rest instantaneously, demonstrates his power over nature, his power over water, his power over the storm. And then they continue on their journey across the lake. So this is not like a 4-day trip. This is all same day stuff, all right? And it says here, they sailed, verse 26, they sailed to the region of Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town.
Okay, if you're new to the Bible, this is when it starts getting weird, okay? You read passages like this and you're like, oh, this book is weird, man. Because you start talking about demon-possessed guys that are going nuts. And this one in particular, listen to this. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." You think, what on earth is going on, right? So Jesus gets to the shore. His disciples get out. They get onto the shore. They start up the hill, and a guy runs to them, and he's screaming and shouting stuff. "What do you want with me? Don't torture me." I mean, don't you think that would be weird? I think I'd be weirded out. And Jesus addresses the man, and you realize he's not talking to the man, nor is the man talking to him. This is a demon. Listen to this. For Jesus had commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places, namely the tombs. Okay, so this guy, tied with chains, broke them. He's naked. He lives in the tombs, and he's crazy. And Jesus asks him, "What is your name?" He's talking to the demon now. "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. In Mark, same story, Mark chapter 5, it actually says, the demon replied, "Legion, for we are many." They begged him repeatedly to order them to go in, not to order them to go into the abyss. So let's just stop here for a second, okay? We encounter a demon-possessed man after we've left the other side of the lake, come to this side of the lake, we've gone through a storm, that's been calmed, still same day, right? We hit the beach, demon-possessed naked guy runs up to you screaming and shouting. He looks at the demons, and the demons say to him, "What do you want here? Please don't hurt us." I love that because in some ways we're so used to the movies that create this battle between good and evil, right? You got good on the one side and evil on the other, and they're like firing at each other, and you and I both know how it's going to turn out. The light comes this way, and then it's this way, and who's going to win? Who's going to do it? And then boom, good wins, and it's awesome, right? But that's not really how it works, folks. If you think God is somehow battling against evil, and we certainly think that he's going to win or know that he's going to win, that's not how it functions. When evil encounters God, this is what evil does. "Please don't hurt us. Please, just don't hurt us." That's the response of the demons. "Please go away. You're scary." Listen to this. It says a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into them, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down a steep bank into the lake and was drowned. Okay, it gets weirder, right? I mean, what's that about? Jesus is like, sure, you can go in the pigs. I mean, the only thing you potentially got is that Jewish people don't like pigs much, and so that could be it. You know, the pigs go, but you go, I don't know, that seems random, and what were the pigs doing there in the first place anyways? And so that's kind of weird. And so you're starting to get more weirded out. And then it says, when those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this in the town and countryside. And the people went out to see what had happened. So the guys raising the pigs, they run to the town. They're like, "Oh my gosh, you got to come check this out. This guy just cast demons out of the other guy, and then it went in the pigs, and the pigs are all dead. You should come see." When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind. This is huge. And they were afraid. Interesting response. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region asked Jesus to leave them, because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. I mean, this story just gets weirder and weirder, doesn't it? So he gets in the boat and left. So what's going on here? The people arrive, they see Jesus, they see that it's true, the pigs are dead, and the demon-possessed guy is fine, and they tell Jesus, "Go away!" And Jesus does. He gets in the boat and goes away. So he's come from the other side of the lake, all the way to here, through a storm, to hit the beach, cast out some demons into a pig, and head back home.
What?
Now, here's the interesting thing. In Mark, we catch a little clue to what perhaps is going on here beyond what we see in the text. In Mark, it actually says, in Mark chapter 5, they told the people about the demon-possessed man who was cured and, big and, about the pigs. He leaves that out here. See, to understand what Jesus is doing here, because so much more is going on here than meets the eye, you have to understand how the region played out. So let me just show you a couple of things here. Take a look at the screen. We have up on the screen here a map, okay? Now, this is the map of the region we're talking about in this story right here. And this map plays out basically this way. This is Galilee right here. And actually, Galilee is probably kind of more like that. That whole region up there is Galilee. Then you have Judea down here, and of course Jerusalem right here, the hub of all of the sophistication of the Jewish people. Then you have Decapolis here, and Decapolis is really sort of a region that runs like this, okay? So, just to give you an idea, of course, Samaria right here, very, very bad part, and that's, we'll find out later, that Jesus disagrees with that, but the Jewish people didn't really do the whole Samaria thing, okay? So, here's the deal. The people in Judea looked up at the Galileans, and they thought that they were backward country folk, okay? They weren't sophisticated. They weren't engaged in the real world. These guys in Jerusalem, they knew how it played out. All the religious leadership, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, their hub was in Jerusalem, and they were the sophistication of the Jewish people. The guys in Galilee looked down at the Judeans and said, they're sellouts. They're sellouts. They were Jewish, but they're no longer Jewish because they're now too much part of the world. So the devout Jewish people, if you will, were the people in the Galilean region. Yes, the people in Jerusalem thought they were unsophisticated, but they were what we would call devout, really engaged in the reality of being Jewish. So this region up in Galilee became known as the land of the 12. Why the land of the 12? Because there are how many tribes in Israel? 12. And it was their way of saying that real Israel, true Israel, the land of the 12 is right here in Galilee. You guys down in Judea, you're not part of the land of the 12. We don't even know if you are part of the 12 anymore. Interestingly enough, Decapolis, which is basically the region of 10 cities, right? Decapolis. It was 10 cities in this area, significant cities that were both Roman and Greek, and a number of other ethnic groups that lived in these cities that had developed. This region was called the Land of the Seven. The reason it was called the Land of the Seven, and we're talking about the region this side of the Sea of Galilee and around here, is because of a passage in Deuteronomy chapter 7. You don't have to turn there, but you are welcome to if you'd like to. I'm just going to read two verses. Deuteronomy chapter 7, it says this. Verse 1, when the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations. So what land are we talking about? The Promised Land, which is this area right here. It says, the Hittites, the Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Seven nations larger and stronger than you. Do you know what the Israelites did with the seven nations? Did they drive them out like they were supposed to? Nope. Did they destroy them like they were supposed to and get them out of land? Nope. And God said, if you don't, it's going to come back and haunt you. And guess where those seven nations settled? They settled in the Decapolis area on that side of the Sea of Galilee. It became known as the Land of the Seven. It was a don't go there land for the Jewish people. It was like going to Vegas, but worse, okay? Because Decapolis was there, and the Romans and the Greeks and the parties and the horrible stuff, and it was the embarrassment of the Israelites, because it just told them day in and day out, because you disobeyed early on, you're still paying the price. So when you say we're going to the other side of the lake, you literally mean we're going to the other side of the world. It's not good. And Jesus takes his disciples and takes them to the beach of the Land of the Seven, Decapolis. They're already nervous, guys. This is already uncharted territory, and they shouldn't be there. Now, in Decapolis and in this region, the Roman and the Greek people worshipped a number of gods. One of the primary gods that they worshipped was a god called Dionysius, okay? Dionysius, that's the Greek name of the god. The Roman name is Bacchus. And this god was actually the son of Zeus, born of a mortal woman, died as a child. Zeus raised him from the dead, so he is the resurrected son of the gods, right? And he is the god of fertility, he is the god of wine, he is the god of celebration. So he is the god of party. He's like a college god, right? And so when you want to worship this god, what you do is you party hard. There was actually a tradition where you put a glass of water out for the night, and this god would change the water into wine. Listen, guys, when Jesus does things in this region of the world, you have to understand everything he does is intentional. There was never a random moment that Jesus did on this planet. You think because his mother asked him to turn water into wine, that's why he did it. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing every step of the way. This God, who is the major God of the Decapolis region, this God is worshipped primarily, you ready for this? Through the consumption of the flesh of pigs. That's right. Do you know why they are raising 2,000 pigs right outside a town near the beach? Because they use those pigs in the celebration and worship of this Greek and Roman God. And they worship him as the resurrected Son of God who can turn water into wine. These pigs are not random. They're not just outside of town because people like eating pigs. They're there because they are the central part of the religious system that these guys function under. And when the pigs are destroyed, you are undermining and crashing the entire religious system by which these guys worship. Now they cannot worship their God, in which case their God's going to get mad and it's going to get ugly. You wonder why the people, when the demon-possessed man is cured, they don't come running and going, "You cured him, unbelievable." What do? They go, "Where are the pigs? Go away!" They want Jesus to leave because he took their pigs and he killed them. 2,000 of them, Mark tells us, 2,000 pigs died that day. Jesus steps onto the beach and in an instant, everything begins to change. He heals a man of demonic possession, something granted in our American sophisticated society we're not so used to anymore, are we? Because we don't really need that kind of display anymore, because I think the enemy has strategically gotten us so self-centered, doesn't really need demons to possess us much anymore, does he? But the rest of the world, you see demon possession a lot in the rest of the world still, and I have no doubt it's here in America too. We just don't see it play out quite this way like it did in the pagan societies. But this is real stuff. With guys captured by real evil, and Jesus steps out of the boat, demonstrates his power over demons, his power over evil, his power over the false gods of this world, and his power over everything. And who has he got with him? His disciples. What is he showing them that we need to know as we leave this place to go into the same real world they're dealing with? We need to know a couple of things that I think Jesus demonstrates perfectly in this story. First of all, Jesus is very clear here, showing us that he is going to be a boundary-breaking God in every way. A boundary-breaking rabbi for sure, and he is going to expect us, if we're going to be sent, to be breaking the kinds of boundaries that the religious institutions tend to plug onto us. You see, before Jesus comes, the Jewish people function under the right assumption that God has chosen them, pulled them out, they are special people, and God loves them more than he loves everybody else. But Jesus appears on the planet and says, "The plan has always been that I would love beyond the Jewish people, and I would love all nations and all tongues." So now Jesus is sending us not to our own people, but beyond the borders of the land of the 12 into the land of the 7. And if you're going to go to the land of the 7 and you are going to do ministry in the land of the 7, that is to live out the mercy of God in the land of the 7, let me tell you something, you are going to have to find yourself in some situations that I'm sure the religious institutions are going to frown upon. Think about this, Jewish rabbi, right? First of all, gets on the beach in the land of the 7, bad, unclean, just right there. Steps off unclean. The disciples get on the beach with him, they're already feeling unclean, right? And a naked demon-possessed man charges them.
wait for it. Out of a tomb. Okay, let's go. Unclean beach, unclean demon-possessed man, unclean dead people, unclean tomb. So far, we're going down a good list of unclean, okay? And just as the naked, demon-possessed, unclean man is charging you on the unclean beach from the unclean tombs, you turn this way, and there are 2,000 unclean pigs! At that moment, as a Jewish person, you want to get in the boat and run? Jesus doesn't. He takes all of that, and he engages it, and he says, I stand here with mercy and love and power. And this is what it means when you are sent into the world. See, his disciples are learning fast. And then when the demon-possessed man comes and is healed and the pigs go out and the people come and they go nuts and they chase him off, Jesus gets in the boat and he heads home. A good day's work done. And not only has he demonstrated to us that he is going to be a boundary-breaking God, but he demonstrates to us also that when he breaks boundaries, he has the power over the false gods of this world, the false ideologies, the false philosophies, the false thoughts that are going to be encountered as you go out. How many of you have gone out into the world, you intend with all your heart to display the gospel, to share the things, but the first time you start, somebody asks you one stumping question and it's done. You're like, I don't know, I'm not a pastor. And from that moment on, you're silent at work. Yeah, because sometimes the philosophies and ideologies and gods of this world seem much bigger than we can overcome. And Jesus reminds us here that the truth that he is and the truth that he declares will always ultimately overcome the lies that are born out of this world. So, yes, you'll break boundaries. Yes, it will be hard and uncomfortable. And yes, you will face some truths that are going to be difficult to overcome. But don't worry, because so far Jesus says, when I send you, I will give you power to be able to face those things in their reality. And the best part of what Jesus teaches us in the story is found at the very end of this particular part of the story. Look again at Luke chapter 8, verse 38. Now, it says here, verse 37, he got into the boat and left, right? There's Jesus leaving. The man, verse 38, from whom the demons had gone out, begged to go with him. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you beg to go with Jesus? You're in Decapolis in the land of the seven. You just lived a life demon-possessed in the caves, in the tombs, and he just healed you completely. You are just a free man now, and he's leaving because all your people from your town are chasing him away, and you get to stay. No. That's when you go, take me with you, right? Take me in the boat, please. And you'd expect Jesus to go, anyone that wants to follow me, come. But look what he says. He says, but Jesus sent him away saying, return home and tell how much God has done for you. So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him. What does Jesus do? He takes a demon-possessed man and sends him back into his town and his people in a pagan city where he's just been cast out and chased out to just simply do this. Ready? Tell them what I've done for you. Tell them. Now, you think that's where the story ends. It doesn't end there. See, in the book of Mark, we find out, you can turn back to Mark if you'd like, in the book of Mark in chapter 6, in verse 53. I take you to chapter 6, verse 53, page 699. Here's why. Jesus returns now to the other side of the lake, the land of the 12. In the land of the 12, he does several extraordinary things, including feeding the 5,000, right? He feeds the 5,000 in the land of the 12, he teaches in the land of the 12, he heals the sick, he raises the dead, and then he returns one time back to this region, okay? So he's gone the first time, and what did he do the first time? Lands on the beach, encounters the demon-possessed man, casts the demon out, goes home. Nobody wants him. Second time he arrives on the same beach in the same area, look at what happens. Verse 53, when they had crossed over, they landed. Now, that area right there, slightly different word than the previous one, but it's just a different way of saying the same exact thing. This is exactly the same region, and anchored there. As soon as they got out of the boat, listen now, people recognized Jesus. Why do you think they recognized Jesus? Because the last time he came to the beach, he was the only Jewish rabbi they'd seen in a very long time, and what did he do? killed their pigs. I think they recognized Jesus, right? You ready for this? They ran throughout the whole region and carried the sick on mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, into villages, towns, or countryside, they placed the sick in the marketplaces. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak, and all who touched him were healed. Doesn't that sound totally different? So between the time Jesus leaves the first time, does a few things in the land of the 12 and returns, thousands of people flock to him and beg him to help them. What do you think made the difference? The only thing we know happened between the time he left the first time and he came back the second time was one demon-possessed man telling his story. That's it. That's all we know. And Jesus returns and the people beg him to help them. We were told just a little further on that 4,000 of these people in this region come and listen to him one day, and they're all hungry, and they've been following him for 3 straight days without eating. They're just listening. They're captivated by Jesus' words. And finally, Jesus says, these guys are hungry. We should feed them. And the disciples who have just gone through the feeding of the 5,000 just a little while before goes, how are we going to do that? Like, you guys are seriously insane. He just fed 5,000 people with a few loaves of bread and a couple of fish. You don't think he can do it again? And guess what? He does it again. He does it again. But here's the cool part. You ready for this? When he fed the 5,000 in the land of the 12, how many baskets were left over? You guys know? 12, that's right. When he feeds the 4,000 in the land of the 7, how many baskets are left over? 7, that's right. Isn't that amazing? Nothing Jesus does is without intention. And he says to us, when you go into the world, it's going to be difficult. But I promise you this, as uncomfortable and difficult as it's going to be, that's normal because you're in the land of the 7, folks. And when you're there, as much as the philosophies of this world will seem to be bigger than you, you can overcome them with the simple truths of the gospel and the reality of God's word. And you ready for the final one? You don't need to be a pastor to do this right. You don't need to have all the training. You don't need to know all the Bible verses. You don't need to know Genesis through Revelation. You don't need to have read this book cover to cover. Do you know who changed that region most significantly before Jesus returned? Are you ready for this? A demon-possessed guy who had not been discipled, who had never read the scriptures, who knew nothing except for one thing. Jesus changed me when I encountered him. And when he sends us out, Jesus says the same thing to us. Go into the world and tell them my story. Tell them your story. Tell them what happened when you encountered me. Tell them what I've done for you. And they will know. See, in this room, we're a bunch of tax collectors. I get it. We're a bunch of Zacchaeuses. We're a bunch of ex-demon-possessed crazies. We're a bunch of people that don't have all the training and the degrees and the doctorates and the this and that. But if you know Jesus, then he's here to tell you. If you've encountered him and you know him as your Savior, then you've got a story to tell. And you ought to be telling that story every day. This is what God's done for me. So if I may challenge you this morning, I would challenge you in this. If you're here and you know Jesus, I hope you leave here today and you ask yourself this question, what has he done for me? What has he done for me? Articulate that. Think it through. Measure it. What has he done for me? What freedoms has he brought to me? How is my life different because I know Jesus? Measure it. And then as you see the magnitude of his mercy outside of eternity, but just here on this planet and the freedom he brings to you, and then you measure that against eternity and say, he's given me eternal life too, then you start telling people what he's done for you in that crazy world in which you live. Don't hide from it. Engage the world. There is no win or lose. They don't get to win arguments and you get to lose them. You get to share your story and the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they get to hear it. That's it. When he went the first time, people ran. When he came back the second time, they begged for his help. When you take the story of Jesus and your story into the world, do you think they're all going to respond the first time you tell them? You're out of your mind. But I promise you, Jesus says, if you exalt me, I will draw men unto myself. So go and tell your story. And let your story of the mercy of God become the driving force for what happens in this life through you. Remember, Jesus is reminding his disciples here, I am always with you. In your weakness, I am strong. The Spirit of God resides in you, and he will guide you, he will lead you, and he will show you the way. Now, if you're here today and you don't know Jesus, then I recommend highly that you engage in an exploration of this man. Because let me tell you something. If you choose to explore Jesus, and if you choose to pursue a good, deep looking into who this is, if you talk to some people who have encountered Jesus for real, I have no doubt that he will become the most compelling person you have ever pursued. And eventually, my prayer for you is that you will be one of the 4,000 sitting at his feet 3 days straight, just listening, captivated by his words, as we so often are, those of us that know him. May you pursue Christ, because he is more than man. He is the creator and sustainer of the universe. He came, he lived, he died, he rose again. He is the resurrection. And he stands over the false gods of this world and demonstrates his power so that we would know he is with us. May you know what he's done for you, and may you tell your story to everyone that you encounter in some fashion. Let's pray. God, thank you for this incredible demonstration of your power over evil, your power over demons, your power over false gods and philosophies, your power over this world. Thank you for demonstrating your mercy in the midst of that power, that you don't come in with flaming arrows and harsh words, but you come with mercy and love, grace, and you call us to the same life, to share our story of mercy with those whom we know. Holy Spirit, may you empower each of us to get a clarity of our story, a clarity of what you've done for us and what you continue to do for us, and may you empower us to share that story with our circle of influence so that they may know your mercy and know your love, and so that they too may come and beg for you to rescue them as we have begged and you have rescued us. When we are overwhelmed, God, in a world full of tsunamis and earthquakes and death and destruction and passport control and everything else in the middle, may you remind us that he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world, and that you have overcome all of that, and that the gospel message and the gospel power will overcome all of that. May we live our lives without fear, uncomfortable on the shores of the land of the seven, ready to face the false gods we encounter, remembering that though we are simply a demon-possessed ex-convict, that you have healed us of that, and that we now have a story to tell. And may we tell it boldly as he did. And may we see thousands come to know your mercy because of it. We love you, Jesus. Speak to those here who don't know you. Spirit of God, let them know how much you love them. Draw them to yourself. Grab their hearts and tell them, come, seek me. Explore me, and you will find me. Let them know, God. We love you, Jesus.